ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. Attorney General Pam Bondi promised to end the weaponization of the Justice Department. Critics say she's weaponizing it, rewarding the president's friends and punishing perceived enemies. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Has an advantage in the trade war. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. President Trump backed off some tariffs for now, but not against China. We called Orville Schell, an American who has observed China for decades. Also, why does a journalist group say press freedom is no longer a given in the U.S.? And how teens across the country are prepping for the finals of a national poetry performance competition. It's Monday, May 5th. This day in 1961, a rocket carried Alan Shepard 116 miles up, the first American in space. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump gave a startling reply to a question yesterday during an interview with NBC. Trump said he didn't know if he is required to uphold the U.S. Constitution. NPR's Asma Khalid has more.
The context for this was a series of questions about whether non-citizens in the U.S. deserve due process. The president believes, frankly, he has a mandate, he thinks, on immigration, and said if you talk about due process for people who are not in the country legally, you'd have to deal with millions of trials. The backdrop to this is the high-profile case of a man who was sent from Maryland to El Salvador, despite a court order saying he should specifically not be deported there. The Supreme Court has called on the U.S. government to facilitate his return, but thus far he remains in El Salvador.
NPR's Asma Khalid reporting. An exhibit in a federal building in Washington that honored victims of gun violence no longer exists. The Trump administration has taken down the memorial created by the Department of Justice under President Biden. NPR's Kristen Wright reports some families are upset over the decision.
The Trump administration removed all 120 portraits from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. Robert Godwin Sr.'s portrait and biography were part of the Faces of Gun Violence exhibit. His daughter, Brenda Joyner, is upset, especially because she wasn't notified beforehand.
Should there have been some bit of notification to us? Absolutely. But do I want my pictures, dad's picture sitting at the bottom of a dumpster? Hell no. No.
The Justice Department, in a statement to NPR, says, quote, the ATF will continue to honor the memory of all victims of violent crime, while at the same time preserving the rights of law-abiding Americans. A spokesman didn't answer a question asking where the portraits are now. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Stocks opened lower this morning as President Trump threatened a new 100% tax on imported movies. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 70 points in early trading.
President Trump said in a social media post he's directing the Commerce Department to begin the process of imposing a tax on foreign films. Trump complained about the incentives that other countries offer to attract filmmakers. The news is weighing on entertainment stocks, including Netflix and Warner Brothers Discovery. OPEC and its allies plan to start pumping more oil next month. That's pushing crude oil prices down. The West Texas benchmark is now under $60 a barrel. That's below the price many U.S. oil producers say they need to justify drilling a new well. Retail gasoline prices held steady overnight at about $3.16 a gallon. AAA says that's 2 cents higher than a week ago, but 10 cents lower than this time last month. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, stocks are still lower. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is now down more than 85 points. At 41,232. The NASDAQ is down about 100 points. This is NPR. High-speed trains in Spain have been hit with delays today. Spanish officials say that some of the cabling used in the train's signaling system have been stolen from four different locations. Thousands of people have been traveling home after a holiday weekend in Spain. Some people were stuck overnight in their rail cars. Many airline passengers are complaining. That's after United Airlines announced it would eliminate about three dozen daily flights at one of the nation's busiest airports. NPR's Amy Held explains.
United announced the cancellation of 35 round-trip flights every day from Newark Airport because the technology air traffic controllers rely on has, quote, failed. In a statement, CEO Scott Kirby says it's clear the airport cannot handle the planes scheduled to operate there. This weekend at Newark.
It's really awful.
Odette Fortier planned to join her tour group, but got stuck on the tarmac.
We're going on a tour that we're meeting the group in Athens, so we can't go another day.
It's not just Newark. Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy says unless a whole new air traffic control system is built, people will lose lives. The current system relies in part on floppy disks and World War II-era radar. Upgrade funding is under consideration by Congress. Amy Held, NPR News.
Roman Catholic cardinals will convene their conclave Wednesday to select the next pope. After each vote, they burn their ballots. Black smoke says they'll take another vote. White smoke means the next pontiff has been chosen. The Vatican Fire Brigade has now installed the chimney on top of the Sistine Chapel. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Israel is planning to limit the way that food and supplies are distributed in Gaza.
Israel says it is the only way it will allow any food back into Gaza, where people are going hungry. An Israeli official says it's part of a plan to take over more territory and expand the war. The main aid groups in Gaza, including the United Nations, are refusing to take part.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is covering this story in Tel Aviv. Daniel, welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
What exactly is the plan?
Israel's cabinet approved it last night, and it completely changes how the 2 million people of Gaza would get their food and their basic supplies. I got details from five people, including officials with knowledge of this plan. Each one of them spoke on condition of anonymity because the details have not been officially released, and it's very sensitive. But it's a plan to shut down hundreds of community kitchens and food distribution points across Gaza, and instead, Israel would allow for just around 4 to 10 designated aid centers in southern Gaza.
Okay, limited number of aid centers. Who would run them?
Well, the centers are supposed to be run by an American security contractor in coordination with a new foundation recently established in Switzerland that we know very little about. Israeli soldiers would not run them, but they would guard the periphery of this zone. And Palestinians would be coming to these places, registered and screened through facial recognition technology. They'd pick up parcels for their family. Israel says this whole operation is an attempt to isolate aid from Hamas and to weaken the group. And an Israeli official tells us it's actually part of a bigger strategy to get Palestinian civilians to move en masse to a smaller, more consolidated area of Gaza so that the military can expand the territory that it's taking over in Gaza. And the army is already starting to call up more soldiers.
Thanks for that bit of reporting. What are aid groups and the United Nations saying as they reject this plan?
They put out a statement together, and they say basically this is not an acceptable aid plan. It's a military plan. They say you cannot use life-saving supplies to achieve military goals. They also say that large groups of people will simply struggle to reach these new aid centers, so think pregnant women or the elderly. So what we're seeing is this serious standoff over the very basic necessities of life, and it's happening at a time of extreme desperation in Gaza. Israel has been banning food and supplies, everything, for more than 2 months into Gaza. This is the longest full blockade it has ever imposed. So bakeries are closed, food kitchens are closed, hunger is widespread.
Daniel, you said something about an American contractor being part of this. Is the United States on board?
Very good question. The Trump administration has not commented specifically on this plan, but President Trump has said that food needs to get into Gaza. He is coming to the region next week. I should note that a former U.S. official told me that Israel actually tried to implement a version of this aid plan under the Biden administration's tenure, but the Biden administration said no. According to the international laws of war, it said that anyone who needs aid must get aid. You cannot vet. You cannot fight a war through manipulating humanitarian aid. That's what the Biden administration said, but Trump has not made the same demands on Israel.
One bit of news from the weekend, there was a big bomb crater that I saw outside Israel's airport. What happened?
Yeah, the Iranian-backed Houthis in Yemen fired a missile. Israel failed to intercept it. It landed around the international airport near Tel Aviv. More than a dozen airlines have canceled flights. And the Houthis say that U.S. has struck back at targets overnight in Yemen.
NPR's Daniel Estrin is in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Let's go back to another major story we've been following, President Trump's tariffs. Those tariffs on imports from most countries are at 10%. His tariffs on China, though, 145%. China has retaliated with its own triple-digit tariffs. But Trump's commitment to the strategy continues. In a post on Truth Social last week, Trump threatened sanctions on entities buying oil from Iran, and China buys almost all of Iran's oil.
Now, the White House has framed any negotiations between the two countries as a matter between their presidents, Trump and China's Xi Jinping. But neither leader seems to be willing to make the first move. A. Martinez spoke with Orville Schell. If you follow China, you hear this name. He's been an authority for decades. He's the director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society.
As the geopolitical order shifts, is this China's moment to seize?
Well, I think there is an excellent opportunity for China to move into the space being left by Trump sort of vacating the world. After all, nature abhors a vacuum. However, I'm not so sure that Xi Jinping and China have the skills or the ability. We find ourselves in a place where I think both leaders, Donald Trump and Xi Jinping, are very thin-skinned, very sensitive to making any concessions, which might appear to be hallmarks of weakness. So this means that we're in a kind of a retaliatory spiral where neither side wants to sort of make the break that might stop the spiral.
How ready is China for this kind of trade war?
I think China is a very export-dependent economy. And to keep their growth rate up, they have to manufacture way more than they can use.
How damaging could this be to China long-term?
Well, I think it could be quite damaging. It also could be very damaging for the United States, because a couple of things are really important here. One are the choke points that each country has on the other. And we are using those in the United States. For instance, one choke point the United States has is microchips. But China also has choke points, which it is starting to use. Rare earths would be one for magnets, for cars, you know, military hardware. Rare earths, it turns out, are a small element, but an absolutely critical one in sort of modern manufacturing.
Yeah, and when you mention rare earth, Ukraine and the United States just wrapped up and signed their deal for rare earth minerals. How much of a blow is that for China, considering that that is one of the big things that China has as an advantage, the majority of the rare earth minerals on the planet?
Well, here's the problem about the Ukrainian deal and our mining of rare earths within the United States itself. We do not have the capacity to extract the minerals we need from the ore. Almost all of the rare earth ore that is mined around the world goes to China for processing. So they will still have a lock on a very important part of the production of rare earths.
Now, we've just been talking about the two heavyweights in this fight, China and the United States, but how much of a disruption will there be for the rest of the world as the United States and China figure out who's going to win this battle?
Well, if the United States tariffs of 145% remain, China is going to be even more inclined and under pressure to export elsewhere and possibly at more reduced costs. So let's just look at Europe. They could pretty much wipe out the European auto industry, which is the heart and soul of the German economy.
Yeah, essentially what we're talking about, higher costs for manufacturing, higher costs for everything, the supply chain possibly being disrupted again. I mean, we're talking that kind of thing again?
Yes. I mean, the global supply chains are infinitely complex, where products, before they get to the consumer, ricochet back and forth from country to country, and supply chains are dependent on many other places. And we sort of confected this reliance on China at a time where we thought, well, political systems don't matter. And now we discover that political systems do matter, that if Russia attacks the Ukraine and were China to do something in the South China Sea or the Taiwan Straits, suddenly China's form of governance and whether we have good open channels with them to negotiate solutions matters immensely. But everybody's in bed with everybody in a geopolitical world that is got tremendous tension points that remain not only unresolved, but becoming more fraught.
Orville Schell is the director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Orville, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
A group of high school students from across the country is in Washington, D.C. this week to compete in the 20th annual Poetry Out Loud National Finals. Students memorize and perform poems from a variety of styles and time periods. We asked some of this year's 55 competitors about how they're preparing.
My name is Emily Porter. I'm from Logan High School in Logan County, West Virginia.
The Coming Woman by Mary Weston Fordham.
Looking at the poem, you have to dissect each section as a way to fully understand what the poet is trying to say.
Dear me, what a slow, pokey man.
Right now, I am spending my days watching myself in the mirror, watching each move that I make to make sure that the moves that I make are interpreting the poem as they need to be interpreted.
My name is Zeke Moses, and I'm a freshman at Bexley High School in Columbus, Ohio.
America, I Sing You Back by Allison Adele Hedge Coke.
To be so honest, I was never the type of person who loved poetry or appreciated poetry to the fullest. But as I've gone through this process, I've developed a newfound love of poetry.
Before America began to sing, I sung her to sleep, held her cradle board, wept her into day.
My name is Nyla Dinkins. I attend Benjamin Banneker Academic High School in Washington, D.C.
Learning to Read by Frances Ellen Watkins Harper.
I think judges really want to understand or see that you can understand the poem, and then also you can be the vessel of that information. And I think the way in which you make that poem your own is something that's really like powerful for judges to see.
Our masters always tried to hide book learning from our eyes. Knowledge didn't agree with slavery. 'Twould make us all too wise.
That was Nyla Dinkins from Washington, D.C., Zeke Moses from Ohio, and Emily Porter from West Virginia. They spoke with NPR's Elizabeth Blair. The champion of Poetry Out Loud will be announced Wednesday night. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Sarah Snoop. She's won an Emmy and 2 Golden Globe Awards for playing Shiv Roy on the HBO series Succession. She's now on Broadway as the only actor in a new staging of the play, The Picture of Dorian Gray. She plays 26 different roles. She performed the role in London last year and won an Olivier Award. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at Progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Attorney General Pam Bondi says she's ending what she called the weaponization of the Justice Department during the Biden administration. What is the case that she's weaponizing it herself? NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas looked into some of the early acts of the Trump Justice Department.
At her confirmation hearing in January, Attorney General Pam Bondi vowed to fight violent crime and to restore confidence and integrity to the Justice Department.
The partisanship, the weaponization will be gone. America will have one tier of justice for all.
Like President Trump, Bondi argues that the department was politicized under the Biden administration to target Trump and conservatives more broadly, and they point to the prosecutions of Trump himself as prime examples. John Lauro, who served as Trump's defense attorney in some of those cases, says Bondi is tackling weaponization head on. Here's Lauro speaking at a recent event with the Conservative Federalist Society.
So we now see no political prosecutions, no sham indictments, no fake grand jury proceedings, but instead a way of looking at the Department of Justice in terms of restoration and ensuring that the rule of law will be carried out going forward.
Liz Oyer is the former pardon attorney at the Justice Department.
I think what's happening in the Department of Justice right now is that it's being transformed into Donald Trump's personal law firm.
Oyer and other critics say that, in fact, Bondi is taking actions to politicize the department herself.
The attorney general has made it clear that directions are coming from the very top, from the president, and she is there to do his bidding. That means pursuing enemies of the president. That means doing favors for friends of the president. The Department of Justice is essentially whatever the president wants it to be right now.
Oyer was fired in March after she declined to restore gun rights to the actor Mel Gibson, who is a prominent supporter of President Trump. Oyer says she had public safety concerns due to Gibson's domestic violence conviction. Ultimately, Bondi gave Gibson his gun rights back. But it's an example of concerns that Oyer has about what is driving decision-making for the new department leadership.
Career professionals, experts in their field, are being marginalized, and decisions are being driven by political considerations, uninformed by the knowledge and expertise of the career staff.
Bondi and her top lieutenants previously served as Trump's personal defense attorneys. Under their leadership, the department has fired prosecutors who worked Capitol riot cases or investigated Trump, pushed out senior officials at the FBI, and dropped cases against the president's political allies. One example critics point to is the corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. In that instance, the department leadership directed prosecutors to dismiss the Adams prosecution, suggesting that it interfered in the mayor's ability to help Trump with immigration enforcement. Nearly a dozen prosecutors resigned in protest. One of them was Ryan Crosswell. He worked in the public integrity section in Washington. After prosecutors in New York refused to drop the case, the then acting deputy attorney general gave lawyers in Crosswell's office 1 hour to find 2 attorneys among them to sign the court papers dismissing the Adams case.
We felt we had 3 options, and I don't think I'm just speaking for myself. One was to resign en masse, 2 was to be fired, or 3 was that someone would sign the motion.
In the end, 1 attorney agreed to sign it, Crosswell says, to save the public integrity section and its mission, prosecuting corruption, including criminal conflicts of interest and people that profit from their government positions.
I think that losing the public integrity section would be devastating because the work's so important. It's been serving the public for nearly 50 years.
Days later, Crosswell resigned. He had been a federal prosecutor for around a decade. He disputes that the department ever was weaponized, and he finds the current leadership's talk of ending it ironic.
And even if you did think that it was weaponized, then the correction to weaponizing the department is not to do it yourself.
Certainly, enforcement and policy priorities shift from administration to administration. What's going on now, Crosswell says, is something altogether very different. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Another change at the Justice Department involves a memorial to victims of gun violence. It was created by the agency under President Biden, but the Trump administration has taken down both a physical memorial and an online companion. NPR's Kristen Wright reports that some families are upset over the decision.
On Easter Sunday, Brenda Joyner marked 8 years since her 74-year-old father, Robert Godwin Sr., was shot to death not far from her home in Cleveland in a random act of violence.
He was literally the, you know, the parent that was just everything to us.
Her father's portrait and biography were part of the Faces of Gun Violence exhibit, removed from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives headquarters. The Trump administration took down all 120 portraits of gun violence victims. Law enforcement officers who died had also been honored in the memorial. Joyner says she had no idea this was happening, and she's devastated.
Should there have been some bit of notification to us? Absolutely. But do I want my dad's picture sitting at the bottom of a dumpster? Hell no.
The Justice Department, in a statement to NPR, says, quote, "The ATF will continue to honor the memory of all victims of violent crime, while at the same time preserving the rights of law-abiding Americans." The spokesperson did not answer a question asking where the portraits are now and whether families had been notified about the removal. ATF enforces federal gun laws and is tasked with regulating the firearms industry. It's within the Department of Justice. Brady, United Against Gun Violence, is one of the groups that helped plan the remembrance. Chris Brown, who's president, says taking down the exhibit is part of the administration's efforts to roll back firearms regulations.
What they want to do is deny the reality that gun violence exists, and that makes me very angry.
President Trump signed an executive order in February directing the Attorney General to examine all regulations and guidance involving the Second Amendment. Brenda Joyner now works for Brady and says the exhibit was not just a wall of pictures.
And I felt like this country was, you know, actually taking recognition and taking note of all the lives that are lost to gun violence.
Robert Godwin Sr. was pictured smiling and preparing fish he just caught for a family meal. Joyner would like his portrait returned. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
As of May 7th, if you board a plane, you will have to show a picture ID compliant with the Real ID Act. Implementing the 20-year-old federal law has been easier said than done.
It comes with ideology, view of the world, technology, your identity, how much information you share.
I'm Elsa Chang. Why Real ID took so long to be enforced on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is threatening to implement a 100% tariff on movies produced outside the U.S. but shown here. As NPR's Mandalay Del Barco reports, the president says he wants movies to be made in America.
On social media, Trump wrote that America's movie industry is, quote, dying a very fast death, and that Hollywood is, quote, being devastated by other nations that draw filmmakers and studios away from the U.S. with incentives, something he calls a national security threat. His post did not give any details about his tariff plan, but it appears to be his solution to the fact that many American films and TV shows are produced internationally. Countries like Canada, the UK, and Australia give productions lucrative tax incentives, rebates, and grants. Trump blames California Governor Gavin Newsom for allowing that to happen, but Newsom has already proposed boosting his state's tax incentives. Mandalit Del Barco, NPR News, Los Angeles.
Crude oil prices are dropping now that OPEC says it plans to begin pumping more oil next month. The West Texas benchmark has fallen below $60 a barrel. Union workers at Pratt & Whitney are on strike in Connecticut. About 3,000 employees of the jet engine maker walked off the job this morning over pay and benefits as their contract expired. This is NPR News. The process of selecting a successor to Pope Francis begins this week at the Vatican. Roman Catholic cardinals from more than 70 countries will begin a conclave on Wednesday. They'll gather in the Sistine Chapel following Mass. Francis died last month of heart failure at the age of 88 following a stroke. Elon Musk's Starlink satellite service is now available in the Democratic Republic of Congo. As Kate Bartlett reports, the rollout comes as the DRC negotiates a minerals deal with the Trump administration.
The SpaceX CEO, who is also an advisor to President Trump, announced on X that Starlink is now available in DRC, which had previously rejected its rollout as a possible security threat. The country did an about-turn last week, shortly after talks with Trump's Africa czar regarding a possible peace deal with Rwanda-backed rebels in the resource-rich East. Musk has been making an aggressive push to sell Starlink in Africa, but it's still not available in his birth country, South Africa, which has affirmative action laws for foreign companies that Musk objects to. For NPR News, I'm Kate Bartlett in Johannesburg.
The shoe company Skechers is being sold for $9 billion. Earlier today, the company's board unanimously approved the deal with investment firm 3G Capital. Skechers will remain based in California. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 78 points. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. And from Linda Moodbell Learning Centers, one-to-one instruction to help students catch up or get ahead, online or in-person instruction for reading, comprehension, and math. LindaMoodBell.com/NPR. This is NPR.
On a Monday morning, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Press freedom is, quote, no longer a given in the United States. That's according to a new report published by the Committee to Protect Journalists. That's a nonprofit organization that promotes press freedom around the world. CPJ normally waits about a year into any new presidential administration to evaluate its impact on the free press. But under the current administration, the group decided to act sooner. Here to tell us more is Catherine Jacobson, lead author of the CPJ report. And she's the program coordinator for the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean. Good morning, Catherine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
So what led your team to conclude that press freedom is, quote, no longer a given in the United States? That's actually a pretty disturbing statement.
Yes, indeed. So the first 100 days of the Trump administration were marked by a flurry of executive actions that we concluded have created a real chilling effect and have the potential to curtail media freedoms. So what we're talking about are challenges to access, so journalists being able to even get into the White House for various events that they would previously have been able to have access to. We're talking about the weaponization of regulatory bodies and legal frameworks against news organizations as well, in addition to continued targeted attacks against journalists in newsrooms. And it's all of these actions kind of taken individually might seem like a one-off case, but when put together, paint a really alarming picture of deteriorating media freedom in the U.S.
What do you think it means in practice, especially around the country? I think many people might be aware of certain actions directed at media organizations based in Washington, D.C., but what about elsewhere?
Yeah, so it might seem like insider baseball in D.C., right? Things that are happening far away. But it's not. It's really creating a permission structure for local leaders to behave this way, both in the United States and then globally as well, right? What happens in the White House matters. And when the Associated Press, one of the world's largest news organizations, can't get into certain White House events because of decisions they've made about calling a body of water the Gulf of Mexico versus Gulf of America, right? That has real impact on you know, journalists' ability to do their work, and also ability for the American public more broadly to have an understanding of what's happening in those rooms that organizations are excluded from.
I assume that you reached out to the White House about these findings. Did you get a response?
We did not, no.
So let me note here that NPR and public media are explicitly mentioned in your report. President Trump signed an executive order last week that seeks to end federal funding. The Federal Communications Commission is investigating whether NPR's corporate sponsorship credits comply with federal regulations. Other news organizations like CBS and 60 Minutes have been targeted with lawsuits. And as you just mentioned, the White House has been in a sort of a legal battle with the Associated Press over access to presidential events. When you consider all these actions together, what do you think the administration is trying to do?
You know, it's difficult to say what they're trying to do, but in effect, what's happening is that it's creating a less free media environment and creating a chilling effect, which in some ways is very difficult to quantify, very difficult to undo, and the impact, I think, will be felt for decades to come, quite frankly. It's kind of the intangible, you know, of slowing down the process of reporting and scaring off news outlets from covering stories that the administration perhaps might not want to be covered.
Before we let you go, just 30 seconds here. Does your organization have advice for journalists and news organizations?
Yes, I think continue doing your job. There are lots of organizations to support you. And I think it's really important for Americans to understand the role that journalists play as watchdogs in their community. You know, what reporters do is really hold power to account. And without a robust and free press, it's very difficult to have that accountability.
Catherine Jacobson is the lead author of a new report about diminishing press freedom in the United States by the Committee to Protect Journalists. Catherine Jacobson, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Safe to Sleep is a campaign to help prevent babies from dying in their sleep. It's been around for decades. It's seen big results. And now the Trump administration has shut down the office responsible for leading it. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Originally called Back to Sleep, the campaign launched in 1994 to bring awareness to sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. At the time, more than 4,000 infants a year died from the condition. Dr. Rachel Moon is a researcher at the University of Virginia. She helped write the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines on safe infant sleep. She says after the campaign launched, those deaths decreased by 50%.
Which is huge. We've saved thousands and thousands of babies' lives because of this.
Safe sleep recommendations for babies include laying them down on their back instead of their stomachs and avoiding loose blankets, pillows, and bumpers that could strangle or suffocate them. This information was distributed on social media as well as in pamphlets targeted to specific groups, like grandparents, and in different languages. All of this material was produced and distributed by the Communications Department for the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. Shriver was the aunt of current Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. As first reported by Stat News, that entire department was terminated on April 1st. Moon's contact at the office emailed her to share the news.
Just wanted to let you know that since the office has been terminated, so has Safe to Sleep. And that was it.
Moon says she was shocked.
For this to be pulled without any notice, you know, at a time when these deaths are increasing, is devastating, frankly.
After holding steady for years, sleep-related infant deaths rose by nearly 12% between 2020 and 2022. Researchers think the rise may be related to parents not getting the information on safe sleep they needed during the pandemic, when access to healthcare might have been more limited. Allison Jacobson is with First Candle, a nonprofit that has participated in the Safe to Sleep campaign since it began. She says the group will continue its efforts to educate parents on safe sleep recommendations, but it doesn't have anywhere near the funding needed to replace the resources that the NIH provided.
You know, state agencies, departments of health, hospitals would reach out to them and ask for all of these free resources to be sent to them, which they were able to do. We don't have the ability to do that.
We reached out to the National Institutes of Health for comment and received an email saying, quote, no final decision has been made regarding the future of the Safe to Sleep campaign. And the email said the campaign materials remain available on the NIH website. When I went onto the Safe to Sleep website, the pamphlets and other materials could still be downloaded, but many were listed as temporarily unavailable for order. Allison Jacobson says she's all too familiar with what can happen when parents don't get the safe sleep information they need. She says she's often heard this as part of First Candle's bereavement support services.
I can't tell you how many times it breaks my heart when we have parents in the group saying, nobody told me, or I didn't know. I didn't know I couldn't have a blanket in the crib. I didn't know about anything.
She worries that going forward, it's going to be that much harder to get information out to help parents keep their babies safe. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Covering the news for you, this is NPR News.
In his book, I Seek a Kind Person, Julian Borger tells the stories of children who escaped the Holocaust thanks to ads in British newspapers. One ad saved his own father. Next time, Here and Now.
Staying informed is more vital than ever. With NPR by your side, it is easy to keep up with the latest news. We're at your fingertips on your phone. Listen live at this station's website or npr.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. People in Australia are required to vote by law, but they also get a perk, democracy sausages. Snacks at polling places are an Australian tradition. It started with bake sales in the 20s. Portable grills in the 80s helped to make Election Day sausages a thing. People say sometimes that a close look at politics is like watching the sausage get made. Voters may not want to do that, but at least they can eat it. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. From the Doris Duke Foundation, which aims to support the well-being of people and the planet for a more creative, equitable, and sustainable future. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. All right, the trial of Sean Diddy Combs begins in New York today.
The record executive, rapper, and businessman has been in federal custody since his arrest last September. He faces charges that include sex trafficking and racketeering conspiracy. He's pleaded not guilty.
NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento is covering the trial for NPR in New York, and this report lasts about 3 minutes. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Many people have followed this blow by blow, but what exactly is Combs on trial for?
Yeah, I mean, he's on trial for a number of alleged activities that center on the abuse of women and others around him. So prosecutors are basically alleging that Combs used his significant power and his business empire to protect himself from the repercussions of those actions. So for one, he faces charges of sex trafficking. That means forcing or coercing someone to engage in commercial sex acts. Aya Gruber is a criminal law professor at the University of Southern California, and she says that especially after the trials of Harvey Weinstein and the NXIVM cult case, the legal definition of commercial sex is quite broad.
Courts are willing to define commercial sex as an exchange of sex, not just for money, but for anything of value.
So, for example, promising to help someone's career could potentially be considered something of value in some instances. Hmm. Combs also faces charges for transporting people across state lines to participate in commercial sex. And the third charge, racketeering conspiracy, is what ties all of this together. Prosecutors allege that Combs directed his employees to organize and conceal these sex crimes for over a decade, and Combs has pleaded not guilty to all of these charges.
How did these criminal charges relate to the civil sexual assault lawsuits that Combs also faces?
You know, the civil law and the criminal law are two completely different systems, but there is a lot of overlap in the behavior described here. So you're absolutely right. Combs faces dozens of civil lawsuits. Some listeners might be familiar with the R&B singer Cassie Ventura, who filed the first prominent civil lawsuit against him. But that's not necessarily what this trial is about. He's really only on trial for the criminal charges in the indictment that we just discussed. However, there is a chance that some of the alleged victims who filed civil suits have also been cooperating with this criminal investigation. So even though there are two different legal roads when it comes to Sean Combs, there could be some intersecting here.
And we have this question now that comes up whenever somebody who's extremely famous is put on trial. How do you select a jury for a case like this where so many people have probably heard something about it?
Yeah, I mean, Combs is from New York City and he's a huge star. So there's really a high chance that potential jurors here will already have some opinions about this case. Both the prosecution and the defense submitted proposed questionnaires for what they'd like the jury to be asked. Combs' team included questions about how jurors feel about wealthy celebrities, what kind of music they listen to, and how they might respond to evidence that, you know, describes people engaging in sexual relations with multiple partners. On the prosecution side, several of their key witnesses are alleged victims who will be testifying against Combs under pseudonyms. So the prosecution also proposed asking whether jurors would be more or less likely to believe a witness who testifies under a different name.
Really interesting. So if he is convicted, how long could he go to prison?
So Sean Combs has been in custody since he was arrested in September. He's been denied bail multiple times. And if he's found guilty of all of these charges, he could be spending the remainder of his life behind bars.
Man in his mid-50s. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
The Oracle of Omaha is bowing out.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Legendary investor Warren Buffett is stepping down as head of Berkshire Hathaway after 60 years.
The time has arrived where Greg should become the chief executive officer of the company at year end.
That is the man himself making the announcement at Berkshire Hathaway's annual shareholder meeting in Omaha, Nebraska. The Greg he mentions is Vice Chairman Greg Abel.
I would still hang around and could conceivably be useful in a few cases.
Susan Schmidt is portfolio manager at Exchange Capital Resources, and she was at that shareholder meeting. Susan, good morning.
Good morning.
Can we just, you know, remind folks real quick about Buffett's legacy in the world of corporate America and investing and what he has built here?
Warren Buffett has done something that really helps society understand the power of investing. And what Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, who passed away recently, what Warren and Charlie did was really emphasize the importance of buying companies, looking to them for the long term, and showing that they could have great success over time with that.
Warren Buffett's successor is Greg Abel, who was vice chairman within the company. What do we know about him? What's it going to be like with him at the helm?
Greg has been around for a long time. He's not a new face. And in fact, he's been the designated successor since at least 2021. What's interesting was that Warren's announcement was clearly a surprise to Greg as well. He's come from the energy side of Berkshire Hathaway, and he's participated in these shareholder meetings with Warren and Charlie over the years. He's been part of the planning, and Warren includes him and mentions him frequently, making sure that his investors and shareholder base know that Greg is fully aware and participating in the investment decisions that are being made. And I think the crowd is comfortable having seen Greg and having had this exposure to him as really the key investment person, that this will continue and the style will not change of their investments as they go forward.
Susan Schmidt, portfolio manager at Exchange Capital Resources, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is pretty much flat, doing nothing. S&P 500 is down 0.4%. The NASDAQ is down 0.6%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.35%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Bitwarden Password Manager, helping to secure personal logins during every career shift, fresh start, or new opportunity. Learn more at bitwarden.com. And by Mercury. Mercury brings together banking, credit cards, and financial software to help businesses manage their finances. Learn more at mercury.com.
We return now to our Odd Job series, What's That Like? Today we learn what it's like to work in aquatic animal medicine. Dr. Cara Field works at the Marine Mammal Center, a teaching hospital located on the California coast.
My name is Dr. Cara Field, and I am the Director of Conservation Medicine at the Marine Mammal Center. I am one of those people that got my interest and started really young with animals, probably 5 or 6 years old. You know, what do you want to be? I was like, a veterinarian. I was very fortunate to grow up on the coast, but I didn't know that there were vets for aquatic animals.
Long before us, great travelers were crossing our oceans, risking it all to ensure the future of the next generation.
There's not really a focused track for aquatic animals or too many exotic species in veterinary medicine. Most schools have the option to do out rotations or externships. So I was fortunate to do such a rotation here at the Marine Mammal Center when I was in vet school. And I was able to go to Florida to Moat Marine Lab and work there for a few weeks, where I got my first real exposure to sea turtle medicine and met some manatees and some dolphins. And it was like, these are very different species from the seals and sea lions I'm used to.
Hand flippers.
In wildlife medicine, we get animals in where we don't usually know their history. There'll be like a sea lion that's on a beach, unable to move. And in that case, you're like, well, it could be anything. So we do our very best to figure it out with the tools we have. And if we don't have the tools, we'll see if we can make the tools. It's not easy. They don't like to tell their secrets. So we have to get a little creative with how we learn about their health issues. The first time I cared for a baby harbor seal, it was like, oh my gosh, this thing is so cute. You just want to squeal and go like, oh, come on. But you can't. I know the best thing for that baby seal is for me to stay away, except for when it needs that care, and then let it be with the other harbor seals and be a harbor seal. I think for a lot of folks that work with these animals, the feeling of satisfaction, of happiness, of joy, and releasing them back into the wild and seeing them go home is overwhelming sometimes, especially because the other side of that, the severe injury, the mortalities, like those can really weigh on you. I was in Louisiana during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, and we received hundreds and hundreds of oiled sea turtles. And I did not know what to do with those oiled sea turtles because there was no reference. You know, nobody had cared for that number of oiled sea turtles. We came up with plans, and some seemed to work well and others maybe not so well. But in the end, we were able to release almost all of those turtles. But some of them were just, I mean, you could barely tell it was a turtle under all that oil. And that's a direct human impact. We can fix, you know, some of these animals when those direct impacts are felt. But how do we do better beyond that? So those are the kind of big picture questions. I'm like, I feel unsatisfied with, you know, my contribution there. Like, how can I do better ultimately? My family was supportive of my interest in science. And I think that's a lot of why I was able to get where I am, is because of that support. Even when I failed, even when I didn't get into vet school, it wasn't like, oh, well, do something else. So, you know, that's one of my take homes to folks who are trying to get into this field and make it, and is like, keep trying. It's not perfect. It's not a perfect system. Our desire isn't enough. So keep after it.
You can tell us about your odd job at morningreport@marketplace.org. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.